A note to our listeners, this episode contains discussion of suicide. Let's get this out of the way right at the top. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. It's kind of preposterous, the names of some of the people that Shanti Das helped bring to your ears in her long career as a music industry executive. Outkast, Erykah Badu, TLC, Usher, Toni Braxton. I'm just scratching the surface here. The list is long. Shanti Das was on top of this very competitive, very high-stakes industry for many years. Then, in 2009, she quit for her mental health, which was not in a good place. But that move didn't solve things. After that, Shanti experienced some rough years, some personal tragedies, some periods of suicidal ideation. Eventually, she found a combination of things that helped, good therapies, meds that worked, and some assistance from a pastor who is now a U.S. senator. Her recovery led Shanti Das to start a nonprofit advocacy organization called Silence the Shame. So now, instead of promoting Usher or Outkast, she's promoting positive mental health and suicide prevention. Her organization has a new app called Silence the Shame. Shanti Das, welcome to Depresh Mode.
Thank you. And I got to tell you, John, when I heard the title of the show, I'm sorry I'm not a listener already, but I'm definitely going to subscribe and tune in and go back and listen. But growing up as a young girl, I used to listen to Depeche Mode, and I thought,
sure,
how brilliant is this? So,
yeah, you honor. And me both. I think we're of roughly the same generation. I think,
exactly.
I think we're at those same listening experiences. So I want to take you back because it seems to be a pivotal time. At the end of 2009, you left your job in the recording industry. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask about your mind at that time in a minute. But first, what was your professional life like? Who was Shanti Das in the recording industry at that time?
Wow. Shanti Das in 2009 was executive vice president at Universal Motown. And that was probably the highest position that I had reached in my almost 20-year career in the business. I got my start in 1991, just as an intern at Capitol Records, and started working at LaFace Records in the early 90s, helping to launch the careers of like Usher and Outkast and Toni Braxton and TLC, some pretty cool artists.
Yeah.
And, but by the time 2009 rolled around, I was overseeing an urban marketing department, probably overseeing about, I don't know, 8 staff members, including administrative roles, and working directly with the president of Universal Motown and chairman Sylvia Rhone, who was one of the top female executives in entertainment. And so I, you know, again, kind of had, I wouldn't say peaked, but it was the highest position that I had gotten. But it was just a really stressful time for me personally and professionally.
Yeah, what was happening with your mind that led you to leave?
So I think it's important to note that my dad died by suicide when I was 7 months old, and it was difficult for my mom, and we kind of buried a lot of those feelings. So I never dealt with that unresolved trauma. And when I first moved to New York City in 2010 is when I kind of started experiencing like anxiety and stress in the workplace, because working for LaFace Records, it was more of a boutique situation. So once I started working at the larger companies, I thought, what is going on? There's a lot of, you know, drama in the building, a lot of yelling, a lot of arguing. I was like, okay, this is a dysfunctional family. I'm happy to be here. This is new to me working at the larger companies. And so I remember, John, in 2010, first saying, like when I was dealing with a lot of stress being at a new company, because after LaFace Records was sold, I moved to New York City with L.A. Reid, and he replaced Clive Davis. And so I remember one day kind of having a meltdown at the airport going, this is just too much. And when I got home that night, I told my boyfriend at the time, maybe I should just kill myself. And he thought, wait, what? You know, and it scared me just even saying those words out loud, because it was the first time I had even just, you know, uttered those words, right? And after my dad taking his own life, you know, he took it serious and he was like, well, wait a minute, we need to call your sister, who was like my best friend and confidant. And so that's when she was like, you need to go to therapy, young lady, and finally deal with dad's suicide and kind of like how it, you know, prevents you, if you will, from dealing with your own emotional stress and wellness. And that's when I first went to therapy. But over that kind of 10-year stretch of being in New York City from working at several large record companies, I wasn't, you know, engaging in self-care. When I did go to therapy, I don't think I only went for like 3 months and I stopped. So my mind was, it was just a lot of stress, a lot of pent up anxiety, a lot of, I think, depression. I was starting to miss home. My mother was developing Alzheimer's. So that was happening. But I just didn't know how to deal with a lot of the stress in the workplace. And so it was manifesting itself both physically and mentally for me.
What was it doing physically?
So I remember in 2009 riding, and I was going to a meeting. Our offices were in Midtown Manhattan, and I had jumped in a yellow cab going up to Harlem to a meeting, and my entire right side went numb. Like I couldn't feel my hands, my arms, my legs. And of course that freaked me out. And so I went and got all these tests that day, MRIs, CT scans, that sort of thing. And I was diagnosed with cervical spinal stenosis, and it was like the fluid wasn't getting properly into one of the vertebrae in my neck, but my doctor said it was all a direct result of stress. And I'm in my late 30s at this time. And he was like, that is nothing that someone your age should be dealing with. Usually most of my patients are like in their 60s, 70s, 80s, right? Being diagnosed with that. And so it was directly stress related. And again, it was a lot of politics in the workplace. Me being a young African-American female trying to navigate my way through the corporate politics of the record companies was difficult at times. And again, I didn't know what to do with that stress. I wasn't eating much. I wasn't sleeping a lot. I was traveling all the time. I remember not too long ago, I ran into one of my drivers that used to drive me to the airport and stuff like that in New York. And, you know, we were just laughing and getting reacquainted. And I share with him some of my story. And he was like, I don't know how you did it. He said, you know, I drop you off at 1 a.m. and one of my other drivers was coming at 4. So in addition to just the workload of the organization, John, I was completely stressed out. I was literally going into the office, and I had a pretty cool office, you know, a sofa and a big screen TV. But John, I was taking naps at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And anybody that knows me, I'm type A personality. I am everybody's worker bee, right? I'm always on point, and I took my job very seriously. And I think that's why I was able to, you know, to achieve a title like executive vice president. But it you know, the mental health wasn't mental healthing for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't working for me, and I wasn't addressing anything.
So was leaving just a result of a considered change that you needed to make, or were you just not able to do it?
So I didn't have like a psychotic break or anything, but I did have a meltdown, and it was a serious consideration after my sister said, look, you're getting diagnosed with things that are now starting to affect you physically. We know that sometimes you can't focus mentally. And I had been in New York for 10 years, and she was like, it's time to let it go. I mean, because clearly, you know, you're not taking care of yourself. You don't really have the support system in New York that you need. You haven't really gone back to therapy. You know, I only did that once. And so I made a really tough decision. I walked away from a $500,000 a year job, corner office, and said, you know what? I'm just going to go back home to Atlanta and figure it out. And that's what I did. Of course, it was a shock to not only my boss and, you know, some of my colleagues, but folks that I worked with in the industry for so many years. They're like, you're doing what? Like, who does that? No one walks away from the music business at this level, you know, having, you know, achieved a great amount of success, launched careers of some really important artists. And quite honestly, you know, had the opportunity to make a lot of money and travel, but I didn't care anymore, John. I had to walk away and figure out life for me and what that looked like. And at the time, you know, we're talking 2009, mental health wasn't a word that was thrown around. Nobody was talking about it. And nobody even talked a lot about, you know, the promotion of, you know, self-care and even physical health and eating for your health and wellness, both mind and body. So I just kind of went back home, like just trying to figure it out. And so I think it's important, like, that those next 4 years for me now becoming an entrepreneur and then dealing with some financial ups and downs, because the nest egg eventually goes away. And then the straw that broke the camel's back for me was in 2014. My best friend died by suicide, and I talked to her like 12 hours before it happened. And so that, of course, was like one of the hardest things I've had to deal with. And I kind of blamed myself a little bit because I had talked to her. So it was like I was running through that conversation in my head, like, what did I miss? And
right. What could I have done? Yeah,
exactly. And so that made it difficult. And I think that really was the catalyst for sending me into a downward spiral in 2015. And even though I was, you know, still high functioning, I was really hurting on the inside and withdrawing a lot from friends and family, not wanting to get out of the bed at times. I mean, it would be sunny and 80 degrees outside and I'm like in bed. And so I knew that was a problem. And then one Saturday in September of 2015, I had counted up all the pills in my medicine cabinet. No matter what, you know, prescription drugs, over the counter, I was counting them all up and I seriously considered taking them. And I just kept hearing these like thoughts in my head of like, kill yourself, kill yourself. And I had been having those thoughts kind of throughout the summer. I had even shared it with some of my friends that I just didn't really want to be here anymore. And I was kind of not feeling like myself. And so we went through that, and that, but that was the closest that I ever came to like kind of having a plan, right? And so that night, I don't know what got me out of the house. It wasn't that I wanted to die. I just wanted the pain to stop and I wanted those thoughts to go away. And so I just started driving around town in my area. And ironically, I went into like this store called At Home, like one of those home goods type stores, and just started walking around. I mean, it's 8 o'clock at night. I just was like, I knew I needed to get out of the house because I just didn't trust myself. And I thought that I would carry out the act. And so I ran into a friend who lived way across town. And I'm thinking, what are you doing on this side of town? And she could just see it all in my face and knew something wasn't right. And I kind of shared a little bit with her. I don't recall the exact words, but she knew that I was in crisis, and she was like, I need you to call your sister immediately. And so I called my sister from the parking lot. I was sitting in my car, or I was in the store, and then went to my car. And she said, you know, I told her what was going on. And she said, okay, well, right now what I need you to do is hang up and call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK. And that was, you know, well before 988. And so I called them and I talked to a crisis counselor for about 25 minutes, and they kind of like talked me down and throughout the crisis. And then once we hung up, I texted my pastor, which is interesting. And I know you've heard this before, that a lot of times people in the African-American community, you know, we're just taught to pray our problems away. Although I think that narrative is shifting now, but it still holds true in some areas of the community. But I texted my pastor, Dr. Raphael Warnock, and he said to me, he said, I'll pray with you, but you need to get help. And he and some of the other clergy at the church had seen me coming in church on Sundays, and I'm bawling. Just, you know, any little song would get me to cry, and I'd go down to the altar. And so I think they could see that I was in some sort of emotional turmoil. And so I took his advice and my sister's advice. And then that Monday morning or the next day, I had reached out to my primary healthcare physician, who recommended a psychiatrist. And so I went and saw the psychiatrist, and that's when I started on Zoloft, on my antidepressants. And that was the beginning of my wellness journey and trying to just get back on track. And I'm just grateful that I did not attempt suicide, but I came really close to taking those pills.
Just ahead, trauma is a powerful and tricky thing, has long-term effects. Back with Shanti Das, who lost her father to suicide when she was a baby. I want to ask about the trauma of your father's death by suicide. It happened when you were a baby, but trauma is such a tricky thing. And I think a lot of people don't understand how it can get passed around and passed down like that. How did that death stay with you and affect you so profoundly when it happened when you were so young?
Thank you for asking that question, John. And I think a lot of people would think, oh, well, you were only a baby. You didn't know. It shouldn't be a big deal. How did that right. affect you? I've heard all of that, right? And I'm like, well, so I recall being like, 4 or 5 years old when my mom really kind of explained to me what death was, what that meant. I remember being in the kindergarten and I was in a group circle of friends. And, you know, you kind of get in that circle and you talk about what your plans are for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I'm going to go. My dad's coming to see me. And so my teacher was like, you know,
I don't think so.
Yeah. And so she was like, we really need to address this. So after that, she called my mom and they came up and sat me down and told me that, you know, dad wouldn't be coming back and kind of explained to me death and heaven and all that kind of thing. But then the kicker was when we got home and I was like asking all these questions like, well, what happened to dad? Why isn't he coming back? How did he die? And when she was honest with me, she told me that he took his own life. And boy, I got so mad and so angry. And I was like, what do you mean? And why did he do that? And so I was then dealing with that one stage of the grief journey, which is anger. Mm-hmm. And then that just caused a lot of shame and a lot of trauma within my household. Even my sister, who was 8.5 years my senior, you know, once we got older, we were talking about how embarrassed we were about dad's death. And, you know, you'd meet people in the community or at school and they'd say, oh, well, what happened to your dad? And it's interesting how we never talked about it together, but we both eventually realized that we were both lying to friends and family saying, oh, he had cancer or mm-hmm. dad had a heart attack. Anything other than telling people that he had died by suicide. So that level of just trauma and anger and disgust and fear was really kind of just manifesting on the inside. And because we didn't talk about it and we didn't get it out in the open, it's like we compartmentalized it, but we hid it and buried it. And so people know that when you don't deal with those sort of traumas, eventually they will manifest itself later in life when you start dealing with other type of anxieties and traumas. And that's exactly what happened. You know, nothing traumatic per se happened to me in the workplace, but it was just this prolonged level of anxiety and stress that I was dealing with. And it kind of got me to my breaking point. And that's when I started looking back at myself going, well, is something wrong with me? And, you know, was I predisposed to something mentally because my dad took his own life? And when the going got tough, you know, sure enough, it's something that, you know, I thought about and I considered it. So, John, I always thought something might be wrong with me because of my dad. And I wasn't studying genetics and I didn't know anything about being predisposed to trauma or that sort of thing. I just always was afraid that something was wrong with me and that I would do the same thing that my dad did.
Were you angry at him?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Incredibly angry. I used to tell my mom, because she always used to say, oh, my gosh, you remind me of your dad. And he loved you so much. And I would say, don't bring that man's name up to me. And I don't want to talk about it. And my mother never went to counseling also when he passed. And so, like, I would see her crying at times. But my mom, instead of going to therapy, she kind of dived straight into her faith and used her faith as a way of coping, which a lot of people do. But I do wish she had have coupled that faith journey with, you know, therapy and even family counseling for us so that we could kind of understand what it meant as children to grow up with a father who had completed suicide and kind of what that looked like for us to deal with that anger and that shame early on so that we didn't have to carry it on into adulthood trying to still figure it out. Like, my sister went to counseling for her first time in college. And she said, I guess, at a recommendation from a friend. And she said it changed her life, being able to finally forgive dad. Whereas I was well into my 30s when I first went to therapy and forgave my father as an adult. And I was weeping like a baby.
I bet. Well, it's people misunderstand that what trauma does, that it's not a matter, especially, you know, if it's that foundational to who you are, you were built on trauma. Like, so of course it's going to show up, you know, later on. The people raising you were traumatized. So it gets soaked into the bones so deeply. I think people don't realize that all the time.
100%. And I do recall, like, one of my uncles telling me that, so my mom was Black, but my dad was Indian. He was South Asian and from Kolkata or Calcutta, they call it either name. And so, you know, mental health was dealt with very differently over there. And I remember my uncle saying that my dad, you know, had been depressed. He didn't leave a note, but I don't know if, you know, genetically depression ran in his family again, because they didn't talk about it. We didn't know a lot about it. And this is sad. Like, I remember my mom saying at times that, like, my dad's family, we would only kind of write to them. We were talking early 70s. So we would write by mail, handwritten letters, but they blamed my mom for a short period of time, not really understanding. And that was traumatic in and of itself, because my mom was already dealing with the shame and guilt that, you know, his family thought that she did it, but then having to deal with the fact that they blamed her, you know, that was just like a double whammy. And again, I hate that she never addressed all that and she never remarried. And I really think that that had a lasting effect on her as well.
It's interesting that, you know, you got this advice from your pastor, who of course is now a U.S. Senator, that it wasn't an either or. It wasn't, you know, if you have prayer, you don't need medicine. If you have medicine, you don't need prayer. It existed at the same time. What role, and I know you're a person of faith as well, what role has prayer and religion played in your recovery?
So I will say prayer and just my relationship with God, not necessarily a specific religion per se, because I was raised Catholic and then went to a non-denominational church, which helped me a lot in New York. And now I'm a member of Ebenezer, which is a Baptist church. So for me, it's my relationship with God and understanding his place in my life. You know, I am a firm believer. Again, I never try to impose my beliefs or positions on other people. But for me, it's been profound. And there is on this journey, it hasn't been an either or type situation, right? They have both coexisted in terms of my recovery and my wellness journey. So I start my mornings, you know, just thanking God for waking me up. And I felt like, you know, God created all these wonderful people and, you know, doctors were a part of that group, right? And so why wouldn't we utilize therapists and, you know, psychologists and that sort of thing to help us through our journey? So it's been great. I've had an ongoing relationship with going to therapy when I felt like I needed it. If I need spiritual counseling, I'll talk to my pastor or other friends of faith that I fellowship with quite often. And, you know, and also I'll tell you, like, over the last 5 years, I've had to really go through a tough grief journey because my sister, who I was speaking about recently, she passed away unexpectedly from a blood clot. And that was like one of the hardest things. It was the hardest day of my life and probably worst day of my life. And I still struggle with that, but I lean heavily on my faith to help me get through it. But then I also lean heavily on, you know, seeking therapy or support groups when needed. And then I became my mom's caregiver through the pandemic, and she had Alzheimer's and she passed away 2 years ago. And so there are times where I still just question my existence, like why God left me here and allowed my sister and mom to go on. And then I'm here and then being an advocate, which we haven't really talked about yet, but I do work now in mental health and then this is like my life's work now, but it's still hard and heavy at times. So being able to pray and ask God to give me the wherewithal to get the help that I need or to just clear my mind when I need it, like, it's a huge part of my life and a part of my daily regimen.
I want to ask about Silence the Shame and about the work that you're doing with that, because it's so wonderful. But has your recovery been kind of a smooth journey upward, or has it been kind of a two steps forward, one step back kind of thing?
So I would say in the beginning, it was pretty smooth before because I started doing this work around Silence the Shame. I think that in and of indirectly was a part of my recovery, just being able to pour into other people and see the positive impact of really sharing my own journey and story around emotional health and wellness and how I was helping others. But when I was having to deal with the death of my sister, I think I started drinking a little bit more. I never had a problem with alcohol, but sometimes I would have, like, you know, we drink casually, and working in the industry like entertainment, we're always like socializing and having to go to dinners and conventions and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And so for me, I started, like, you know, that one occasional drink at home turned into two turned into three, and alcohol was a natural depressant. So I saw myself having to really climb out of the funk, if you will, at times, and being even more depressed during that grief journey. And so that I think that is probably the biggest issue that I've had. And so now I really am mindful about really being intentional. If I do have a social drink, that it is social and that I'm not using it as a means to cope. I've never been a drug user. But you smoked a little pot back in the day, you know, but nothing heavy. And again, not judging anybody, but for me, I know that alcohol is a natural depressant. And so I try not to use it in ways of coping. I try to go out and take walks. I immerse myself in nature. I get out there and get that sunshine on my face because I know the vitamin D is going to put me in a better mood. And so I know better now, so I think I can do better. But I think the ups and downs would probably just be my relationship with social drinking and how I had to kind of like really get a hold of that before it became a problem.
More from Shanti Das in just a moment. Back with Shanti Das, mental health advocate and founder of the group Silence the Shame. When did Silence the Shame start?
Silence the Shame. So I came up with the term right around, I think, the end of 2015, you know, after my suicidal ideation. And I was doing a radio interview in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were talking about mental health. And I said, you know, I don't know why it's such a big deal that people are afraid to talk about their mental health. Because shortly after I had contemplated suicide, there was a music industry event in Atlanta, and it was a lot of my peers there, and I received an award. And I revealed for the first time that I had heavily contemplated suicide not too long before that. And of course, you know, you could hear a pin drop in the room. Excuse me. And people were very surprised, of course, but very empathetic. So when I did this radio interview, I was kind of talking about, you know, other things. And I said, you know, I don't know why it's such a big deal talking about mental health. Like, why are people so embarrassed about it? I said, we just need to silence the shame. And then, of course, me having the marketing background, I thought, that's actually
that's catchy.
kind of catchy there. I should do something with this. So I started utilizing it as a hashtag, John, just on some of my social posting and that sort of thing. And then the next year in 2016, when May rolled around, I said, well, let me try to kind of create a movement and see what I can do. So I enlisted the help of like Nick Cannon, who became our first kind of celebrity ambassador. And he recorded a PSA with us. And we put that out in the city of Atlanta. Well, we put it out virally. But then I did a lot of local press in Atlanta, Georgia around it. And then by 2017, I started meeting other like-minded individuals in Atlanta, different women from all walks of life. One lady, her daughter had taken her own life. And then another lady, her son had attempted, but it was a very serious injury. And he's still living with a brain health injury and still goes through a lot of ups and downs from a depression perspective. So we all just kind of came together, and then I formed an organization, and we started doing community conversations and, you know, just getting other folks on board to volunteer. And that's when I formed my 501c3. Mm-hmm. And because I worked a lot in hip hop back in the day, I had named the organization the Hip Hop Professional Foundation, because I started doing a lot around Atlanta too, like supporting the homeless community and other efforts. But it was really, Silence of Shame was just really starting to catch on. And so we rebranded the name. I got a board of directors, and The rest is history. We're like 7-8 years in, and we have our own day, which I made up in 2017. I said, I'm going to make May 5th National Silence of Shame Day and just see if anybody will post. So we created this little Instagram graphic that literally all it says was May 5th National Silence of Shame Day. And I said, it's an opportunity to talk about it. So I reached back into my digital Rolodex from the entertainment industry and got different artists like a Usher and a Big Boy and other folks in Atlanta, some athletes and stuff, just to post. We got 90 million impressions in one day. I thought, wait a minute. This is kind of cool. This is way before, you know, TikTok and all these other, you know, platforms that was starting to garner millions of views and stuff like that. So I knew then that I had something special with this organization and that it was really a gift from God and I needed to do more with it. So I started reaching back out again into the entertainment community and doing more, you know, collaborations with like Music Cares, which is the foundation arm of the Recording Academy. We partnered with various organizations. In 2020, we were the mental health partner for the NFL Players Association. So we've had some really great opportunities to partner. And then for me, you know, being able to share my story has really been therapeutic for me. Sometimes it can be re-triggering every now and then, but for the most part, I have positive experiences from sharing my journey. And then just to see the people and their interactions and perspectives on like, oh my God, thank you for sharing because it's something that I've been wanting to share or I've been dealing with this with a family member or myself for so long. And so just being able to see that positive impact has had a profound effect on my career. And so I speak now at major colleges and universities for major corporations and organizations like the NBA and HBO and EA Sports and a lot of other cool places. So I've really created a platform for myself as a mental health advocate. And so I'm so excited that, you know, yesterday we just launched our first app, a mental health app with our partner, Microsoft. And it's a free resource to the community that has content and, you know, resources around education, teaching people in the community about the various mental health challenges and disorders. It'll have, you know, affirmations and daily doses. And we're going to include like really cool content on from other influencers and some celebrities and athletes on how they manage their mental health and, you know, how they go about their daily affirmations and that sort of thing. So again, I know there are a lot of apps out there, but we're just trying to continue to build a great resource for the community and bring, you know, other folks that I think people look up to and find out how they're dealing with their emotional health and wellness. So hopefully that'll set us apart a bit.
I've been talking about mental health into microphones, I think, for right around the time that you started, right around the mid-20-teens. And I often feel like things are getting better. Like there, people are more open. People are, you know, like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you wouldn't see pro athletes talking about being vulnerable to mental health conditions. But at the same time, suicide rates are rising and mental health, mental illness rates are rising. Do you get discouraged by seeing the numbers? Do you ever feel like, oh man, you know, I'm working so hard, but the numbers are going in the wrong direction?
Thank you for that. And let me just thank you for your voice too, John, and what you've been doing and how you've been helping to erase stigma with your podcast. I mean, it's definitely appreciated. I do get discouraged at times and sometimes I'm frustrated. I'm like, gosh, we're doing so much good in the community, but are we really moving the needle? You know, a lot of the work that I do is in vulnerable communities and communities of color. And to your point, you know, we're seeing suicide rates rise by 30%, you know, amongst Black youth and so many others. And it's like, what else needs to be done? And I find, which is why I feel like an organization like Silence to Shame is still so important, because we do education and awareness. We don't do direct services. But I'll talk to some of my colleagues who still may work in entertainment. And then they have these great, you know, resources from the HR department or these EAP groups. And they'll go, oh yeah, you know, I see they offer that, but I don't use them. But then in the next conversation, they're like, oh my God, I'm feeling anxious. I'm depressed. I'm like, why aren't you using these free resources? And so I still think it's a lot of stigma there that is not seen and not talked about, even though we have so many other people, athletes and entertainers starting to open up, and especially this young generation, you know, they're very vocal about their mental health. But I'm like, you're vocal about it, but why aren't you going and actually getting the help that you need? So I think there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. We have to continue these conversations. It's like you know, kind of got to keep beating ourselves over the head with the more you see it, right? The more it'll hopefully sink in as to why it is important. And I think also we're just, you know, the world, we're still living in crazy times, even though we are technically post-pandemic, you know, there's a lot of war going on in the world. I think some of our young kids don't understand conflict resolution, and they don't value life as much for whatever reasons. I'm not fully blaming social media, but I do think that, you know, social media has some say in it, whether you're a young person or an adult, you know, constantly looking at this, I like to call the highlight reel for people's lives. They're only showing all the shiny and, you know, really cool vacations that they take, but not showing you all the crap the rest of the time. And again, not, people don't have to share their personal lives, but like, let's just remind people though, that if they are only going to show the shiny parts, just know that no one's life is perfect. Right. And so you can't compare yourselves, because I think as humans, we're constantly comparing ourselves to other folks. And so that's why I think the rates are still there. And some of the suicidal ideation is circumstantial. It could be the loss of a loved one, something traumatic that happened, the loss of a job. People think you have to have a specific mental illness to contemplate suicide, and that's just not the case. We all know that sometimes, you know, suicidal ideation is just based on circumstances and something that may have happened, you know, very traumatic in one day, and how that could lead, you know, to, we see CEOs of major corporations, you know, deal with, you know, financial setbacks and different things within the company. And, you know, for whatever reasons, they may contemplate suicide or take their own lives. So, you know, it's still a lot of education that needs to happen. And again, the world that we live in is, as some of these young people say, life is lifing. And life isn't easy at times, which is why we do need sometimes to talk to a therapist, someone that is objective and that can talk through our problems with us. And I tell people, you know, it's not like the therapist, it's not their role to fix your life. They're supposed to provide healthy ways to cope and to get you to understand things differently and to think about things differently, right? And to unpack the reasons as to why you're either exhibiting certain signs of behavior or thinking a certain way. And so it's still a lot of work to be done, John.
Yeah, there sure is. How about in the music industry in particular? I'm sure you're still very much of that world. You've been talking to artists for a very long time. How do you fight the idea of the tortured artist archetype? This idea that if I go on meds or if I get therapy, then my creativity will die and I won't make such great art. And it ain't true. What do you do when you run up against that sentiment?
Yeah, that's a tough yet fair statement, because I do know how sometimes medication can affect your body or your mind. And of course, every person is different, right? It depends on the chemical makeup of your brain and your body. I do think also that it's incumbent upon these, you know, medical companies, right, and big pharma to try to figure out some better cocktails that can have better outcomes for people, just as individuals in general, because even some of my family members I know have been on, you know, either antidepressants or other medication, and it has either made them gain so much weight, or it's like they're walking around like zombies and the dosage isn't right. So I get that from a creative perspective. What I try to talk to artists about and instill in them is, okay, so first of all, whatever you're doing is not working, right? If you're still depressed and you're drinking a lot and you're turning to drugs and alcohol, that's not the answer either. So let's try to find some sort of happy medium, if that's the case, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe consider talk therapy. And then if you still feel like you need medication, do that. I volunteer with a couple of organizations who do a lot of work with musicians and songwriters. And I find that so many of them still are turning to unhealthy ways of coping, you know, prescription drugs and, you know, alcohol use. And in and out of inpatient treatment facilities. And, you know, to your point, it's like they are super afraid that if, you know, they do get on these other medications, that they're not going to be able to think, and that, you know, these mushrooms or other drugs that they're using still keeps them vibey and creative. But in, you know, essentially it's like you're killing yourself, right? So it's a tough conversation, but I think the more open dialogue and conversations that we have, the more we can also bring other artists and musicians that have had positive outcomes from utilizing talk therapy or medication as needed. But again, making sure it's the right cocktail. That's the other thing too. I think sometimes we get on these medications from a mental illness perspective, and it's not the right cocktail. So if it doesn't make you feel good, you immediately say, you know what? I'm going to stop cold turkey. I'm not taking that.
Right. Right. And you say meds don't work for me, but you've only tried one.
You're not giving it a shot. Med. Right.
Yeah.
But have you asked your psychiatrist to tweak that dosage? Right.
Yeah.
Maybe take it from X amount of milligrams to this amount. Right. To see if that kind of works with you. And so I think it's, again, it's the education. It's being able to talk through that process and get people to know that, look, you're either going to continue down this one road or you can try to get some help that you need. And so I just try to meet folks where they're at and introduce them to other people that have been creative. So I do a lot of the panel discussions and creative conversations and community conversations so that we can bring others into the fold, so that hopefully they'll be an inspiration to others that are not trusting of utilizing either medication or therapy.
How do you sustain yourself, I guess, spiritually, while doing all this work? Because you must talk to a lot of people who are in rough shape, or at least have stories from when they were in rough shape. How do you not take on that psychic damage and get crushed by it? How do you keep your head up?
That's a great question. So my pastor, Dr. Warnock, had this notion of the wounded healer that he talks about, right? Because we're still kind of healing ourselves in this journey, but trying to help everybody else. And I'll admit, I'm a Pisces, so I'm sensitive, and I'm an empath. So I take a lot of this in.
Yeah.
And then I also get a lot of friends and family who text me at, you know, all hours of the night or any day, just trying to get support or help for crisis for a family member. And I just can't seem to tell anyone no. I try to set up healthy boundaries for myself, but that is the one thing that I just don't want that guilt on my heart, that if I don't answer this particular call and something ends up happening, then I'm going to try to blame myself again. So yeah. I just try to be really intentional, John, about stealing moments for myself. You know, if I am doing several events where I know I'm sharing my story, then I'm going to make sure that there is one or two days in the week that evening I'm just sitting out on my couch in Netflix and chilling, or I'm taking a trip, or I'm hanging out with family, or more importantly, I have a lot of friends that I grew up with. And so sometimes we just get together and it's like we're in high school all over again, in a good way. And we laugh and we dance. And so I try to do things that bring out the inner child in me, because to me, that's like, from a positive perspective, things that were joyful for me during my childhood. So that is dancing, that is hanging out with friends, going to concerts, listening to music. I absolutely love music. Music, it transforms us, right? It allows us to escape. And so I am constantly listening to, whether it's gospel music, hip hop, R&B, pop, you know, rock music. I mean, growing up in the early 70s, before, you know, radio stations were so fragmented, you know, I listened to a station here called The 89. So I listen to everything from Bon Jovi to Run DMC. You know what I mean? So I have a really, I think, broad palette for music, and I love jazz. And so it helps me stay happy and it helps me stay centered. Again, sometimes if I'm feeling bad, I'll just go to church. I like physically being in the building. It's something about that presence. And so I have to be, I think intentionality would be the big word for me, because I am busy as a CEO and founder of a nonprofit. I also have my own podcast called The Mebo Show, which is M-I for mind, B-O for body. And I talk to celebrities and athletes around both mental and physical health challenges. So again, I have to establish boundaries for myself and just take time for me, because it gets to be a lot. Suicide and mental health, as we know, can be a heavy topic at times, especially if you're dealing with people that are in crisis. And so if we don't take time for ourselves, then I think it allows us to like internalize everything and then get discouraged about the work. But I have to find the wins in it and just, you know, really like pour into Shanti. I have to love myself first. And I also have to recognize that if I feel myself slipping or getting in trouble, that it's okay to like go back into therapy or, you know, seek a support group or, you know, talk to my pastor. I'm not afraid to ask for help anymore. I think that was the one thing that was a lot of shame around asking for help. And for me, somebody working in music that had marketed all these careers of artists, I'm like, why do I need somebody to fix me when I've like helped all these other folks? And I just realized it was only helping them from a career perspective. But I think one of the best things I can do is understand that, you know, my life is the most important project that I will work on. And if I have to restart, reset, and refresh my life over and over again, that is the most important thing, that I actually never give up on me and that I get the help that I need constantly, since I have committed to being this mental health advocate. And it is a life mission and not just a fad for me.
Ready for one question that has nothing to do with mental health?
I am.
Best concert you've ever been to?
Prince Musicology. or Prince Purple Rain. So when I was in the eighth grade, my sister took me to see Purple Rain at this venue called the Omni in Atlanta, Georgia. And it was like, she was with all her friends and her boyfriend. And I was a little shy at the time. And then I got my uncle to buy me a ticket two nights later. This is a true story. I lied to my mother and I said, oh, I'm meeting some friends. Again, I'm only in the eighth grade. I went by myself, John, and I rocked out all night to Prince by myself. Fast forward as an adult, big girl Shanti, I actually did the marketing on Musicology with Prince. So I got to tour and do most of that that run.
Oh,
and it
wow.
was probably one of the most exciting times in my life. I was like in the dressing room. It's just Prince and I looking at photos on the internet. And I'm like, this can't be my life right now. It's pretty awesome. What about you?
Soundgarden, 1989. Just before they signed to a major label, they played a sweaty, intense show in an underground gym at the college that I was going to.
Yeah.
And it was probably maybe 200 people there and just basically on top of the band. Probably the loudest and best concert I've ever been to. It was glorious.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to some pretty cool shows. And
I bet you have.
I have this quote on my wall, and it really speaks to mental health for me, too. It says, where words fail, music speaks. And so sometimes when I'm feeling really sad or down, I just turn on the music so it can speak to me.
Silence the Shame is online at silencetheshame.com. Shanti's podcast is The Mebo Show, M-I-B-O. Our program exists because people support it with their financial donations, and we really appreciate everybody who has done so. If you have not yet done it, it's fine. You can do it right now. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join, find a level that works for you, and then pick Depression Mode from the list of shows. Thank you in advance. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews, helps get the show out into the world. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached in the United States and Canada by calling or texting 988. It's free, it's available 24/7. Our Instagram and Twitter are both at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Be sure to join our Preshies group. Just head on over to Facebook and search up Preshies and join in. A lot of great conversation happening over there. People sharing wisdom, people supporting each other. It's a beautiful place. Our electric mail address is depreshmode@maximumfun.org. Hi, credits listeners. I recommended a movie last week called Fashionista, But that's not the name of the movie I was thinking of. The name of the movie, the correct name, is Problemista, which is a better name for a movie I have now recommended twice. Depression Mode is made possible by your contributions. Our production team includes Raghu Manavalan, Kevin Ferguson, and me. We got booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings. Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papuchik. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
This is Jeremiah from Seattle, and I love you, and I care about you.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.